91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. We begin today's program with author Neil Pasricha, who's known for his book of awesome series, his TED Talks, and his former position as a Walmart executive. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Neil Pasricha's latest book is The Happiness Equation. It features 9 secrets for happiness. Also, Linda Gastenheimer today, Food and Dining. Have you ever moaned over the amount of food you toss out? Well, we'll visit with Dana Grunders, who put together a guide called The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook. A good place to start is to know the best way to store each food. That's next, Topical Currents, after NPR and Regional News. And it's 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman on our Thursday program. A little chilly in our studios today, Bonnie. She's wearing
an anorak.
A hoodie with the hood up. Linda Gastenheimer is wearing a sweater. It's a holiday for many of the personnel here, so we are kind of alone. So the building seems a little bit chill on the chilly side.
We need some body heat.
Well, we begin today's program talking about a topic we all pursue or try to pursue, usually with some degree of success, but quite seldom with total satisfaction, and that's how to best attain happiness. Even the most esteemed philosophers disagree on how to go about it. So with us now is an expert on the subject.
He's Neil Pasricha, who's well known for his Book of Awesome series. He's also a former top Walmart executive and has a new book called The Happiness Equation. Want nothing plus do anything equals have everything.
So we'll learn all about how to be happy. So we have high expectations of Neil Pasricha.
And he joins us now from Toronto. Welcome to you.
Thank you guys so much for having me here. Hi, Joseph. Hi, Bonnie. Good to be on the show.
Great to have you. Perhaps you, our listeners, know him from his Book of Awesome series. If so, and you want to talk to Neil Pasricha or his TED Talks, our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or email is radio@wlrn.org. So what inspired you to write this book, and how does it differ from the Book of Awesome series?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Book of Awesome was about 5 years ago now, and it came from a pretty dark place. I was in a marriage heading in the wrong direction, and had a good friend that was suffering from severe mental illness. And so that's where the Book of Awesome came from. Now, flash forward 3-4 years, I end up getting remarried. I fall in love again, and my wife, Leslie, and I go on a honeymoon. On the flight home from that honeymoon, she isn't feeling well. We stop for a layover. She goes to the pharmacy, and then she comes to my seat on the actual airplane and says, I'm pregnant. She did the pregnancy test on the actual plane. And so when we landed home in Toronto, I start writing a letter to my unborn child on how to live a happy life, thinking, of course, there's 50 to 75,000 books on the subject. But what I never was able to put my finger on is like an action manual, you know, like a how to do this if I'm not here to help you with it. And so that 300-page Word document on how my unborn child could live a happy life is now being published as The Happiness Equation. That was the origin of the book, where the Book of Awesome was the observation of awesome. This one is the application of awesome.
Well, in the book, you talk about that success doesn't mean happiness, and I'm sure we're all aware of that. But then again, like money, it doesn't hurt.
Well, I know, and you know, my parents are immigrants. You know, my mom is from Kenya, my dad is from India, and when I was growing up, they said, Neil, it's real simple. You do great work, then you have big success, and then you be happy. So if you study really hard and then you get straight A's, you'll get into a great school. Or if you work really hard and then you get promoted, well, then you'll be happy after that. But all the positive psychology literature really kicked off, you know, in 2005, or under Sonia Lyubomirsky's work out on the West Coast, you know, it actually says the model is totally backwards. Instead, if you be happy first, if you choose to be happy and invest in your happiness, we can talk about how, then you do great work. Your productivity, your creativity, everything shoots up. And then you have a big success afterwards. So the be happy part needs to go first. It's not where we're going. It's where we need to start from.
Well, why is it so difficult just to be happy?
Yeah, you know, So one thing that I did when researching the happiness equation was I kind of delved deep into some of the, history of our species. And, you know, we don't talk about it much because, you know, we're living in the present day. But truthfully, our species has been around for 300,000 years, not very long in the lifespan of the planet. But for 300,000 years, we have been looking for problems, finding problems, and solving problems. That's how our brains are oriented. It's why we are, you know, the most populous mammal on the planet. It's why we can see a saber-toothed tiger approaching us in the grass and throw a spear or run away. You know, we've developed these incredibly complex systems to find problems. And it's why in today's design of our world, we scan blood tests from our doctors and look for the high cholesterol. It's why we get a math test back and look for the question that we got wrong. You know, everything we do in our lives is oriented towards finding the problem first. No wonder it's so hard to be happy. Our minds are naturally oriented to seeing problems and seeing things that are wrong quicker than seeing things that are going right.
Well, yeah, I guess we didn't have to see things that were going right in the Stone Age.
Well, and you know, it's only been 50 to 100 years where we've had things like, you know, refrigerators and washing machines and created things like free time. Radios, I mean, we're on the radio now, have only been around, let's just say, just over 100 years. So people had advertisements into their home for the first time and a community in their home for the first time. We have it pretty good, you know. I'm in Canada, you're in the U.S. We're both at the top of the World Happiness Report that just came out last week. And, you know, we take for granted that because our world today is largely safe, is largely prosperous, you know, now we actually have to practice using this muscle that we haven't used for years, which is being happy first and choosing when you get up in the morning to spend 20 minutes doing something that exercises your mental health. You know, I always like to say, guys, that, you know, everyone carries around a gym card now. You know, I want to squeeze in the treadmill at lunch, or I want to squeeze in some weights before bed. You don't hear anyone saying, though, I want to squeeze in 20 minutes of meditation at lunch, or I'd really like to make sure tonight I do my journaling or my five gratitudes before bed, because we don't yet have that as a societal practice. But I think we're just at the start of a tipping point towards people naturally investing in their happiness, thinking consciously like, oh yeah, 20 minutes a day, I know if I meditate, or I know if I go on a brisk walk, or I know if I do a random act of kindness, like that will help me feel better for the whole day, and I will have greater productivity, creativity, sales, all these positive outcomes come afterwards.
If you'd like to join in with a comment or a question, you're certainly welcome. 1-800-743-9576 or email radio@wlrn.org. We're talking with Neil Pasricha, and we're talking about his book, The Happiness Equation. Neil, tell us about your number 8, meaning the 3 tests, the Saturday morning test, bench test, and the 5 people test, briefly.
Sure. Yeah, the happiness equation is 9 secrets. Secret number 8 is developing the most important relationship you can, which is your relationship with yourself. These days, everyone says, and I'm one of the people that did it too on my TED Talk, you know, be authentic, be you. But I'm thinking, you know, if I'm not here and my son's wondering, how do I actually do that, I've left him 3 tests. The first one is a Saturday morning test. This is asking yourself the question, on any Saturday morning where you have literally nothing to do, ask yourself, what do I naturally lean towards? Is it going to the gym? Well, that might mean you might be a personal trainer or starting up a supplements company or, you know, working in sports or fitness or coaching a baseball team. Like, you'll be able to brainstorm hundreds of ideas of your natural passions once you see where you spend your time when you don't have to spend it in a certain place.
What if somebody says, I want to stay in bed and read?
Well, you know what? I had a friend that said that.
Yeah.
His name is Brian Johnson. He said, I just love reading. And now he started a self-help podcast and website where people sign up for memberships on a monthly basis, and he gives them book summaries of all the books he's read, because not many people have the time to do that. And it's a very successful business. Mm-hmm. And so, or, you know, someone like that could work at the library or write for the local community paper. Like, I just think that even if your passion appears sloth-like or whatever to you, that you're hinting to yourself what you naturally enjoy. So that's the Saturday morning test. Okay. The second one is the bench test. My friend Fred got into a number of Ivy League schools. He was much smarter than me. And rather than read about whether Harvard had new treadmills or Yale had a nice campus tour, he actually rented a Jeep and drove to all those campuses and sat for an hour on a bench in the middle of the campus, patiently observing his natural reaction to the conversations that he was surrounded by, trying to figure out, you know, do I fit into this crowd or this crowd or this crowd? And the bench test is testing, you know, a new situation. And it has other names. If you're doing a job interview, call it the office tour test. If you're looking for a new home, call it the walking around the sidewalk test, you know, or the sidewalk test. You know, it's just trying it first as opposed to leaping in to that new home or new job or new school without making sure that you fit in there.
So where did he go to school?
He eventually went to Princeton, and that's where he met professors that he became lifelong mentees of and met his wife, Jen, and they are happily married. So, like, it seems like the conversation is there for him. He was sort of saying, hey, I'm going to spend 20% of my time in class, Joseph, you know, but 80% will be in conversations with people that I live with, et cetera. So I want to see if I fit in there.
Can I ask you a question about the first two of these, the Saturday morning test and the bench test? Basically, they presuppose that people are tuned in to themselves, listening to their quiet voice, and trusting their instincts. And that is not always the case.
No, I know. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, to be yourself in a world that is constantly trying to make you someone else is the greatest achievement. And that's why unearthing these practices, and, you know, I think of myself as a fairly self-aware 36-year-old, decently, but I still do these tests on myself every 3 to 6 months because I'm always like, what do I do on a Saturday morning now? Or like, you know, am I sure that my wife and I really want to live there? Like, how do we test that neighborhood out? Like, I'm asking myself these two questions, but Bonnie, to help, the third test, I think, is more simple. It's called the five people test. And you may recall a very famous article written in the New York Times several years ago called Are Your Friends Making You Fat? And you can see why it was a popular article. It's got a pretty, you know, hooky headline. The answer, of course, was yes. In their book Connected, Nick Fowler and his peers researched that we are literally the average of the five people we're surrounded by. So what I mean is even their attractiveness or their intelligence or their habits and behaviors, if you have low self-awareness, and of course all of us do have that in some parts of our lives, simply take a look at the five people around you and just sort of say to yourself, well, I'm about the average of these people's social skills. I'm about the average of these people's career ambition, you know. The five people test can sometimes paint you a portrait of who you are just because we know scientifically you're approximately the average of five people around you.
Well, that's interesting. Okay, we're speaking with Neil Pasricha. He's an author and director of the Institute for Global Happiness. He's also a popular TED speaker. And his latest book is The Happiness Equation, Want Nothing Plus Do Anything Equals Have Everything. We'll be right back.
And we're back with today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Neil Pasricha. He's the author of The Happiness Equation. Again, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN or email radio@WLRN.org. Neil, in the book you talk about to be leery or to don't take advice necessarily because most advice does have conflicts of interest.
Yeah,
expand
I do,
on
you
that,
know.
Please.
Well, you know, the Book of Awesome was a nice, easy book to write because it was talking about popping bubble wrap and, you know, waking up and realizing it's Saturday and getting called up to the dinner table first at a wedding. So it was simple, and when people said it's a self-help book, I was like, well, I could sort of confidently say, well, I wasn't really telling people much advice. In this book, you know, I'm really wary of the fact that I'm dropping a lot of advice on people's heads. So in secret number 9, the last secret of the book, I say the best advice of all is to not take advice, because as Charles Varlet wrote in 1872, when we ask advice, we are usually looking for an accomplice. And to illustrate this point of truthfully looking inside, and I know, Bonnie, this may get to your point about the self-awareness earlier, I actually illustrate the oldest advice of all, and it's cliches, which are from the French word for printing presses, which were printing words together so frequently that they actually, you know, made the presses together. So these cliches, we hear the pen is mightier than the sword, but then we also hear actions speak louder than words. You know, we hear that good things come to those who wait, and then we also hear, well, the early bird gets the worm. And I'll give you one last one. You know, we always hear things like absence makes the heart grow fonder. And then we hear, well, out of sight, out of mind. My point is all advice conflicts. It reflects the giver's opinion more than your own. If it resonates with you, that's because you have something inside yourself already. And that's the message I want to leave people with at the end of the happiness equation, is that if two or three of the secrets jumped out that you loved, great, it's because you already loved them. If two or three are things you disagreed with, I'm happy with that, because that means you've challenged your own beliefs and defined it to yourself. And that's where I came up with the last secret of not taking advice, which is a strange thing, I know, to put at the end of a business or self-help book, but I felt right. more authentic doing that, because I don't want to be a guru on a mountain kind of guy.
You know, one thing I wanted to go back when we were talking about Stone Age brains and the dangers that lurked, and you said, you know, we live in a safe world and in a prosperous world, and I would think that many people would take issue with that. Because many people are struggling so financially, and as far as safe goes, it depends on where in the world you live. It depends on so many factors, and many people don't feel safe. So,
yeah,
I have to.
I understand that. You know, I think what I'm trying to say, and I want to be careful on, you know, I don't want to speak poorly of anyone that's listening right now, thinking, you know, I do fear for my life on a daily basis. But I'm speaking of the fact that most of us don't fear for our lives on a daily basis. We may have problems, for sure. All of us do. And I'm not talking just hashtag first world problems. I mean, like, you know, you could be in a very troubled or challenging relationship, have someone that's battling severe illness, or, you know, have lost a loved one. These are really severe things. But you know, when you walk outside or when you go to the store, the part of your brain, the amygdala, that typically is firing those fight or flight hormones is being overused in most people, right? Like, we're firing mm-hmm. those hormones when the light turns red and we didn't make it through the intersection, or our boss says, I'm really disappointed with your work on this project, and you're like, you feel like your world is ending.
Right.
But the prefrontal cortex of the brain, the newer component, is trying to fight the amygdala. It's trying to not let the amygdala, as Daniel Goleman puts it, hijack your brain. So what I'm trying to say is you've got this war going on in your head, and happiness can be an antidote, because when you are investing in your own happiness by doing some of the exercise we talked about, whether that's journaling, writing down five gratitudes, going on a brisk walk, what you do is prevent your brain from getting attached to those negative emotions. So I'm prescribing this practice of happiness, not knowing everyone's individual situation, but suggesting that most people are not in life or death situations, that their brain sort of is flashing to them.
You also come out pretty strongly against retirement, saying that you might be, by retiring, kind of going more quickly to the end of the world.
Yeah.
Of course, you're making that statement at the age of 36.
Well, I'm very, very strongly opposed to retirement. This is turning into the most controversial secret of the happiness equation. Let me give you my argument, and I'll let you and the listeners decide. Here's what I put forward. Retirement was invented in 1889 in Germany by Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, who said, if you're 65 or older, and that's an important number because he invented the number 65, which people eventually started copying, and you're infirm, like you need help, then you can, if you want, voluntarily leave the workforce, and it will help our youth unemployment issue, and we'll pay you some money. Okay, big difference between 1889 Germany and today. The average lifespan was 67 years old. Penicillin wasn't invented for 40 years. Now, today, we all live way longer. We all want to retire much earlier. Most people say, oh, I want to, you know, leave when I can. And we've got this extra 20, 30, 40, 50 years of life, which we envision playing golf and sailing into the sunset every day. But the truth of the matter is it's killing us. Okay, Fortune magazine has reported that the two most dangerous years of your life are the year you're born and the year you retire. Everyone, including me, has a story of someone who retired and, you know, in my case, my high school guidance counselor, a week later had a heart attack and died. And people have stories like that. And so what I did for the happiness equation is I looked around the world and I found some incredible research done by National Geographic, which shows that the healthiest society in the world, Okinawa in Japan, actually has no word for retirement. Hmm. Not any word in their language describes the concept of stopping work. Instead, they have a word called ikigai, I-K-I-G-A-I, which stands for the reason you get up in the morning. So what I put forward in the happiness equation is that you don't actually want to retire. In fact, I even say never retire. What I say is to find true happiness, you need the four S's. You need social fulfillment, a structure in your life. You know, I get up, I go to work, I come back home, I have dinner. Like, you need some structure, stimulation of learning new things, and a story to be part of. You know, you're spreading knowledge through the radio station. Someone else can be, you know, spreading literacy at the library. Like, being part of something bigger than yourself. Those four S's, social, structure, stimulation, and story, matter tremendously to your happiness. So I suggest never retire. Just always be doing something you love.
Let's take a phone call or two. We've got David in Key West. David, hi.
Hi. Yes, my question for you, Neil, is just specifically to the meditation you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
The 20 minutes of meditation in the day. Like, I was just wondering, listening to a CD, music, maybe just doing a mantra, chanting a mantra. I just was wondering about the specifics of that.
Sure. Yeah, so the research is from Massachusetts General Hospital. Frankly, it's very, very, very low minimum effective dose. It's simply 2 minutes of doing eyes closed, deep breathing. That's actually the proof point. And what does that do? It increases activity in the prefrontal cortex of your brain, the part of your brain responsible for focus and attention. So I always thought meditation was very inaccessible. I pictured going to the basement, shutting off the lights, and like turning on some loud music. I just couldn't picture doing it. So what I recommend is downloading the Headspace app, H-E-A-D-S-P-A-C-E. It's a free app, which, by the way, I have no personal affiliation with, but I recommend it because it's free, and there's 10 free guided meditations on that app. And they really helped me get sort of introduced to meditation. And I know the science says just even 2 minutes helps my brain. So when you're done your meditation, from there you can more quickly sort of prioritize your day. And ideally what I do is, you know, I kind of cut off the bottom 10 things off my to-do list because the meditation makes it feel, you know, like it's not important. That's my route. And the other app is calm.com, C-A-L-M.com.
Oh, yes.
Another good one as well.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Well, we have an emailer who says, Buddhist principles stress that in order to be content, we must accept that being alive will bring suffering, Thomas writes, and that striving for happiness will only bring more suffering. It's like trying to catch a butterfly. You'll never find it if you chase it, but relax and stand still, and it will land on your shoulder.
Mm-hmm. You know what? I have a theory that's very similar to that. I think of happiness like yoga, and I don't do a ton of yoga, but I love how it's called a yoga practice. The goal is never to be perfect. It's always to be better than before. I agree with that quote because there's another famous quote by Hermann Hesse in Siddhartha, which says, what can I tell you except perhaps you seek too much, that perhaps as a result of your seeking, you cannot find. And that sounds very similar to the butterfly theory. But what I'm trying to say is don't think of happiness as a destination. Think of becoming happier through investing in yourself through some very simple exercises or techniques. For example, my wife and I play Rose, Thorn, Bud at the end of every day, where before we turn off the lights, we each say a rose from our day, something that we're grateful for, a thorn, or something that we struggled with that we want to share, and a bud, or something we're looking forward to. That simple exercise gets us very close to what we know the science says of 5 gratitudes a week making you happier.
Right.
And then it's a nice way to end the day. I'm not trying to be like Mr. Happy by doing that,
but it does make
the end of the day feel good.
Well, we are speaking with Neil Pasricha, an author, director of the Institute for Global Happiness, and popular TED speaker. His latest book is The Happiness Equation: Want Nothing Plus Do Anything Equals Have Everything. Thank you so much, Neil.
Oh, thank you so much, Bonnie. Thank you, Joseph. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Our pleasure.
You're welcome. Thank you. Food and Dining up next.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Bonnie Berman and Joseph Cooper. And it's time for Food and Dining. Who hasn't felt badly about having to toss out what was once perfectly delicious food? Most everyone has forgotten to put leftovers back in the fridge or had to face some now spoiled delicacy. And here's an easy-to-digest stat. Most Americans waste around 1/4 of the foods they purchase. So Linda Gassenheimer is here with help. She has an expert who specializes in saving perfectly good food. Chef, author, syndicated columnist, and our friend, Linda Gassenheimer.
Well, hi, Bonnie. Hi, Joe. Nice to be with you. Yeah, that statistic is unbelievable. 40% of our food is wasted. So how can we take advantage of the waste to help others? And what can we do personally to avoid this food waste? So our guest today is going to help us out. She's Dana Gunders. She's the author of The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, and she has some answers for us. So let's welcome Dana Gunders. Hello.
Hello. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you with us, Dana. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Join us. Do you have any questions or comments or some ideas on wasting food or how not to waste food? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or email is radio@WLRN.org.
And also with us, back with us, is our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. Fred gives the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes column that you can read in the Miami Herald or online. And you can also read Fred's wine column in the Saturday Miami Herald. And first, Fred, we want to say congratulations on the new grandbaby.
Well, thank you. It's Harrison Tasker Westbrook, 8 pounds, 10 ounces, born March 15th.
That sort of sounds presidential, Fred.
Oh, yes.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, good-looking kid. Looks a lot like me.
Yeah, we saw the pictures you sent. Thank you. But, Fred, what are we drinking today?
Oh, I'm going to talk about wine for Easter dinner.
All right, sounds good.
Well, I thought you were going to say wine for infants.
No, it's for the grandparents who need it.
And the mother can't have it yet, so because she's right. Feeding the baby, so we have to drink all the wine. It's a shame.
Okay, I'm sure you're up to it. Okay, Dana Gunders, you're a scientist at the National Resource Defense Council. What brought you to writing about food waste?
Well, actually, I didn't start in the realm of food waste. I started off working on agriculture and farming and really looking at, you know, how do we use less water and really do farming in a sustainable way. And as I was doing that, I started stumbling upon these numbers about how much food was going to waste. And I kept thinking to myself, oh, my gosh, these couldn't be true. You know, 40% of all the food in this country goes to waste. And about 25% of all the water we use actually goes to growing food that never gets eaten. And I kept thinking, oh my gosh, you know, here we are trying to get farmers to be really efficient with their water and fertilizer and all of that, and yet we're not eating the food at the other end.
You know, that's something we never think about. I mean, what goes into having to grow that food and how that's being wasted? It's another way to look at it.
Exactly. Yeah, and it just—it's a huge resource. It's a huge resource implication. Actually, about half the land across the country goes to agriculture.
Well, so where is most of this food waste happening? Is it on the farms, in the markets, the supermarkets, or at our homes, or maybe all of the above? Tell us.
It is all of the above. You know, there are entire fields that sometimes don't get harvested in farms, and in supermarkets you have, you know, you'll walk in and you'll see these very abundant displays, these big piles of apples and oranges, but really not all of those get sold, particularly the ones on the bottom that get bruised because they're at the bottom of a pile, and things like that. But actually, our homes, consumers in our homes, we represent the biggest chunk of food getting wasted out there. And it's just the lettuce going bad in our fridge and the leftovers we don't get around to eating and everything else you wind up throwing out when you clean out your fridge.
Okay, so well, let's start with some responsibility about waste at home, and give us some hints. If we're going to have that lettuce in the refrigerator and all, how do we avoid having it go rotten?
Well, you know, it really starts with shopping and when you're at the grocery store, because when you're at the grocery store, that's really where you're committing to your food. So being careful to think about, you know, buying what you eat and eating what you buy is important. Actually, about 55% of all purchases in the grocery store are unplanned. And as you can imagine, when they're unplanned, you don't always get around to eating them in the same way. So,
well, it's kind of hard to walk by those beautiful big red strawberries and not realize you're not going to be home for that week.
Exactly. And that's the trick I suggest is, you know, I mean, if you're somebody who can use shopping lists and plan your meals, then that's extremely effective. If you're more organizationally challenged like I am, just taking a second look in your shopping cart and just thinking about the week ahead for a moment and thinking, when am I going to eat all this? And if you go through each item and you can't think of a time for some of them, then maybe it's better to skip that item.
You know, I loved your tip in the book, which something I never thought about, is that when you pick up your produce in the produce section, like a lettuce or whatever, and it's been misted with water, that you should shake that water off because it's just going to rot those vegetables. But also, you're paying for the water because it weighs more. I never thought of that.
Yep.
We also had on David Pogue recently, who has a book of tips, and he said with vegetables, herbs, lettuces, all those things, if you just put a paper towel on them and then you put them in plastic, that it will preserve them.
And the supermarkets had those built-in sprayers to make things look like they're fresh out of the garden, and actually they're beginning the aging of the vegetables.
That's right. All right, so now we've got the food, we've brought it home, and we've been responsible about buying. So what's the best way to store things in our refrigerator?
Right, well, you know, almost everything has its own special way of being stored in an optimal way. And actually in the book we have a directory where you can look up over 85 products and really learn that. For artichokes, for example, if you sprinkle some water on the stem and wrap that with a paper towel, that will help an artichoke stay good for long. Asparagus does well. You know, it's asparagus season right now. If you put it in a jar and I do this in the door of my refrigerator and stand it in a jar of water, it will actually last quite a bit longer.
Oh, well, that's interesting because otherwise I find that if you put something like my parsley in a glass of water to keep it fresh, then the water gets spilled over in the entire refrigerator, always.
You do need to be careful about that. But it does help keep the herbs or the asparagus more fresh.
Well, I also found that if I just take a wet paper towel, a damp paper towel, and wrap it around the stems of the parsley, let's say, and put that in a plastic bag, that works very well. It'll keep for over a week that way, I found.
Mm-hmm. I could see that. Yeah, I mean, you know, they're sort of living plants still, so the more you can help them get that water that they need, the more alive they'll stay.
How about cucumbers? Those always seem to go bad in our house.
Mushy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
At the end.
Awful.
But that's what he said. He said you put the paper towel on it, and then you put it in a paper bag, even a cut cucumber.
Well, you know, one thing to remember about cucumbers, and this is true for a bunch of vegetables, is a lot of times people don't really pay too much attention to those drawers in the refrigerator, right? But they do have a purpose, and the best way, their purpose is to preserve humidity, and that helps keep things crisp, and it also creates a different temperature zone in the refrigerator. But if you separate the two drawers that you typically have and you make one your high humidity drawer, so you seal it real tight, or maybe you set it, if it has a little knob, to high or to vegetable, then you can keep things that need to stay crisp in there. So that's where you'd put your cucumber. It's also where you'd put lettuce and carrots and broccoli, and things that tend to wilt. And you keep that humidity in there. That will help. If you set the other drawer to a lower humidity, or maybe you crack it open a little bit, that's good for things that that tend to rot more. So
okay, right. Well, we have a caller here, Brett in Fort Lauderdale. Hello, Brett. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to had a comment in regards to leftover or pieces of vegetables. Whenever I bake, or I mean, whenever I cook anything, I tend to have extra little pieces left over. So I save them all in a Ziploc bag in the freezer. And whenever that bag is full, I will boil it all and make a vegetable stock.
And make a stock or a soup. Good. That's a great idea. You have to,
exactly.
And that's another point she points out in the book is that we should use our freezer. I know I had some green beans left over the other day, and they were going bad, so I just blanched them and then put them in a freezer, and we'll use them later. So that's a great idea,
Brett. I also do
Brett.
The same thing with fruit. So if I have some strawberries or blackberries or whatever left over that's getting a little moldy, I will chop them up and make them into a coulis and use it with yogurt.
Well, that sounds great. Well, thank you for your call, Brett. And we're going to go to a break now, but after the break, I want to talk a little bit about eggs. We're coming up to Easter, lots of eggs being used, and you had a great tip in the book about not putting the eggs in the egg case on the door of the refrigerator, to put it inside, because the door isn't as cold as inside the refrigerator. So that was very interesting. But we're going to take a short break here. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. We're talking about food waste in the U.S. with Dana Gunders. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking about the shocking amount of food wasted in the U.S. Up to 40% is wasted. Dana Gunders is the author of The Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, and she's been telling us what that means to our country, and she's been giving us tips on how we can save some of this waste. But right now, it's dinner in minutes time. So we're not going to waste any food because we've planned the dinner in minutes in advance. And it's an herb-crusted lamb steak with wild mushroom rice pilaf. Now, this is a great Easter weekend recipe, or you could have it for any time. But what I do is I use a steak cut from the leg of lamb. And if you don't see it in the supermarket, ask the butcher to cut it for you. He makes a slice right through the leg, so it's kind of an oval-looking steak, and it has a little round bone in the center. And I coat that with a mixture of breadcrumbs, fresh sage, a little mustard, and under the broiler for 5 minutes aside. And if you can't find the steak, then use it on lamb chops. It'd be a great little recipe for a quick and easy dinner. The wild mushroom pilaf is a very flavorful dish because the rice absorbs the cooking liquid from the natural juices of the mushrooms.
It sounds pretty ambitious for dinner in 15 minutes.
I bet you could do this, because once you have that steak, you just put the stuff on it and put it on the broiler.
All right.
Joe, it's for you.
Okay.
All right. So if you want the complete recipe, and it's really simple, even Joe can do it, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Okay, Tasker, what are we drinking for Easter?
Well, Easter dinner, you know, is not your usual holiday meal. It's not like Christmas, because you very seldom roast a goose. And it's not like the 4th of July, because you never grill a steak. And it's certainly not like the Super Bowl, because you wouldn't be caught dead serving buffalo chicken wings. So when Easter comes, I always look forward to dishes that I hardly ever get the rest of the year. Things like ham, spiral cut, glistening with brown sugar glaze, studded with cloves. Or a leg of lamb redolent of rosemary and black pepper, maybe even stuffed with something exotic like spinach, fennel, goat cheese, or dates.
Is this what you're making, Fred? Sounds really good.
I'm getting hungry. I may make that later today, actually. And while I've never had it, I understand a traditional Easter dessert is a pavlova, which is the base of meringue topped with whipped cream and berries. It sounds great. Linda, have you had that?
Yes, I have, and I've actually made one, Fred.
Oh, very good.
They're very, very famous in England. They use it a lot.
Glad to hear it. So anyway, my job here is to pair wines with all of this, and I can do that. First, so I don't disappoint Linda, I propose a glass of bubbly for each guest the second they walk in the door. It makes them feel welcome. And with the ham, I'd suggest a rosé wine. This is pink meat and pink wine, and it sounds cliche and obvious, but it actually works. And Stoller, S-T-O-L-L-E-R, the Oregon winery, makes a very nice rosé from Pinot Noir. For the lamb, years ago I had roast lamb in Spain with a really top-notch Rioja wine made of the Tempranillo grape. That was perfection. And Marqués de Caceres makes one of those for about $15.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it's really nice. And if you can't find that, you can try a California Merlot, maybe the one by Behringer, at $8 a bottle. And the pavlova needs a dessert wine, of course, and I think I'd serve a bottle of Essencia, it's E-S-S-E-N-S-I-A, which is a sweet wine from the orange muscat grape made by Quadi Winery in California, and it's about $18, so enjoy.
Sounds like some good prices on those wines. Sounds good.
Not bad.
Well, let's go back to Dana Gundis. Dana, we mentioned just before the break about eggs and Easter and all. So there's going to be a lot of Easter eggs for an Easter egg hunt. What do we do with those eggs?
That's right. Well, first, you know, oftentimes around this time of year, you'll see these buy one, get one free, you know, 18 packs of eggs, which is a lot of eggs to use up. And if you find yourself not using them up, make sure that you know that eggs are actually good to eat 3 to 5 weeks after the sell-by date on the package. So,
well, that's interesting. You know, 5 weeks after the sell-by date.
That's right, and that's straight from the FDA telling us that.
Well, let's talk a bit about sell-by dates because there is, you know, if I went through my refrigerator, I could probably find a lot of things that are out of date. But I use them, and I'm still here. But tell us, how do we handle that sell-by date?
Sure. Well, you'll see a variety of dates on food: used by, best by, best if used by, enjoy by, sell by. You know, generally speaking, those are just the manufacturer's estimate of when the product is at its peak quality, you know, when they want to stand by their brand by. But it does not mean the product is spoiled after that date or bad or going to make you sick. And I think that's a pretty common misconception out there. So, you know, when food gets old, that's a natural process of aging. It actually does not make people sick. So you can feel comfortable kind of sniffing your milk and tasting it, and if it smells and tastes fine, you're fine. Now, for eggs, there's a great trick to know, which is that if you put eggs in a bowl of water and they sink, they're still good to eat. But if they float, they've gone bad.
Oh,
well, that's good advice.
Yeah. So now, how do we know that if it's past the sell-by date? And we're a little dubious about this. Do we depend on our sense of smell? What do we do?
Yeah. Well, again, for eggs, you know, it's hard to smell them, so that water trick is nice.
Yeah.
For things like milk and cheese and yogurt, dairy products, then smell and taste are a great way as long as they're pasteurized. And, you know, most products out there, with the only products you really need to be careful with are those that they tell pregnant women to avoid. That's the rule of thumb. So things like deli meats and unpasteurized cheeses are things to be careful with.
What about canned foods? I'll bet I could go to my pantry right now and find a can of beans with a sell-by date in 2014.
Yep. And you know what?
You're not alone, Fred.
Yeah, I mean, canned foods can last at least 7 years is sort of the estimate that I've heard food safety experts use.
Isn't it like if it bulges, then it's no good?
Yes, if it bulges, then something's gone wrong with the canning, and that's definitely not something to eat. Or if they're dented as well, then you should be careful. But as long as the can is fine, it can last years and years.
Well, here's another problem. We're talking about Easter weekend coming up, and, you know, could be a lot of buffets, a lot of family. And, you know, even though we think our houses are air-conditioned and cooler, they may not, you know, they may not be as cool as they should be. So what do we do about the food and the leftovers? What are some hints here?
You know, when you're hosting a dinner like that, one of the best things to do is to make sure that you have some containers on hand that you can send your guests home with, because, you know, we tend to host these big dinners. There's almost always leftovers. And I think people get a little bit shy about asking to take them home. So as the host, if you can have containers and really offer those up for people, that sometimes can get them over the hump, and also the logistics of how they're going to get it home.
You can also force it on them.
That's right.
What about Easter eggs that have been out in the backyard for a couple hours awaiting to be discovered by kids?
You know, boiled eggs are pretty stable. So if it's just been a couple hours, you're probably fine. If it's been much longer than that, you probably want to be careful.
If you find one from the previous Easter, you might want to throw it away.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, you know, that's all very interesting. And I always think that, you know, you have leftovers on the table, and they're out for a few hours. Then you put it in the refrigerator. Then you take it out the next day, and you leave it out again. And that can cause trouble.
That's right. You want to be careful with having food out on the counter for too long, because at that temperature, you know, it encourages more bacteria to grow than if it's in the refrigerator.
So put
certainly
it away.
The quicker you can refrigerate things, the better. But it's perfectly fine. And one thing to be sure to do is those things that you microwave, make sure you're really microwaving them thoroughly, and that'll keep your food good and safe.
Right. That's a good idea. And also, you know, don't put out everything at once. You know, maybe have smaller platters and replenish them might be an idea.
That's a great idea. And also, when you have a big buffet out, if you, you know, have smaller plates that are used, people are less likely to sort of overfill their plate past what their stomachs can handle, and of course they can always go back for more.
Right. Okay, well, we have so many more questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to our callers.
Or emailers.
We could have gone on for a long time, but it's been a very interesting week. Dana Gundes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Her book is Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, and it's really well worth a read, and there's a whole chart there on how to store food and how to buy food. It's a really interesting book. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Joe Cooper and Bonnie Berman, great to be with you.
Great, and congratulations, Fred.
Thank you.
Next week we're going to be talking with Gino Paparella from Gino's Italian Market. He's going to tell us how to choose the best cheese and olive oil in all Italian foods. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's Food and Dining. It wraps up the week for Bonnie and me as well. Tomorrow at 1, it's PRI's Science Friday. We return Monday with an At Your Service edition tailor-made for South Florida gardening. We'll have two master gardeners on hand. Topical Currents at your service. Lead producer Richard Ive, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. And remember, we have free audio archives of our programs at the website WLRN.org. Also follow us at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gastheimer, Fred Tasker, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.